This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The age of Trump, the age of polarization, the age of alternate facts, also seems to be shaping up to be the age of defamation. This week, for instance, came the lawsuit filed against InfoWars, the conspiracy-mongering media outlet most notorious for denying the reality of the Sandy Hook Elementary School massacre.
Sandy Hook is a synthetic, completely fake, with actors, in my view, manufactured. I couldn't believe it at first, and then the weird videos of reported parents of kids laughing, and all of a sudden they do the hyperventilating to cry to go on TV. All I know is something's going on.
InfoWars host Alex Jones now stands accused of defamation and conspiracy, one of several defamation cases being brought against him. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump faces a suit from a former contestant on his reality TV show, whose allegation that Trump kissed and groped her was met by the now standard presidential counter-allegation that she is a liar. The lawyer for porn actress and self-described Trump sex partner Stormy Daniels says she's mulling a similar suit, as is the lawyer for former FBI director Andrew McCabe, who tweeted Thursday that Trump's tweets on the matter would serve such a case beautifully. It's a constant duel of you're a liar, no, you're a liar on the world's biggest stage. But till now, it seems to have taken place with impunity. Larissa Lidsky is a First Amendment expert and dean of the University of Missouri School of Law, and I have a checklist of legal questions for her. Dean Lidsky, welcome to On the Media.
Thank you very much. It's nice to be here.
Let's start with Alex Jones. One suit was filed last month by Brennan Gilmore, who happened to be in Charlottesville and shot video of a neo-Nazi protester running down a counter-protester in the street. Jones and other voices from InfoWars, in a now common refrain, called it all a setup.
They had known CIA and State Department officials in Charlottesville, first tweeting, first being on MSNBC, CNN, NBC, and the mayor is involved. Everybody's a cutout.
Now, he's called a witness a liar, an agent for something sinister for which he has no evidence. Is that defamation?
Well, it certainly can be. So he referred to Brennan Gilmore, a former Foreign Service officer, as a deep state operative. And while in some contexts that might be mere hyperbole, it seems that he is basically calling Brennan Gilmore a traitor. And evidently, Gilmore received lots of threats as a result. So that can be an allegation that tends to harm your reputation. And in this case, it looks like it actually did because it resulted in those threats.
Another case was brought against Jones earlier this month by Marcel Fontaine, a Massachusetts man whom InfoWars incorrectly identified as the Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School shooter, apparently based on a T-shirt that he's been photographed in depicting Marx and Lenin. Now, we know the allegation was false. Does his lawsuit hinge on whether InfoWars knew it to be false at the time it printed it?
Yes, it does. So this happened in the Boston Marathon bombing originally. It's happened in even in the Sandy Hook shooting. The brother was identified as the shooter first, erroneously. But the key here is whether it was a lie or whether Alex Jones and InfoWars were reckless in perpetuating this falsehood that Mr. Fontaine was the shooter.
Reckless because they made no attempt to...
No attempt to verify it. He was wearing a T-shirt that was evidently a parody of communism. I mean, it had, you know, Karl Marx wearing a silly hat.
Now I want to get to Tuesday's development. Three parents whose children were murdered at Sandy Hook Elementary filed a suit against Jones and InfoWars for defamation and also for conspiracy. Jones for a long time maintained that Sandy Hook was not a real crime scene but a false flag operation perpetrated by the government to justify abridging Second Amendment rights or some such nonsense. And the plaintiff's allegation is that Jones and the entire InfoWars operation defamed them by saying they're part of a false flag operation and not victims of a tragedy. And pointedly, they alleged conspiracy as well. Why is that significant?
I think in this case, there's a symbolic value to the conspiracy claim in saying this is a whole organization based on perpetuating lies and alternate facts. So it's not just Alex Jones doing it as an individual. It's an entire business model about defaming individuals.
It's clear that they won't be satisfied to see an apology or a cash payment from Alex Jones or some such penalty. They want to shut him down. Is this a path to do so?
Potentially. The aggregation of all of these defamation lawsuits have the potential to bankrupt InfoWars and bankrupt Alex Jones. Our country has a strong, strong commitment to free speech. And we even protect people, for example, who deny that the Holocaust ever happened. This lawsuit is about sending a message that what Alex Jones has done is simply not acceptable and it's not free speech.
All right. It's not just Alex Jones and it's not just Parkland. It's not just Sandy Hook. It's also, as we've seen, Pizzagate. It's a supposed political murder of Seth Rich, a Democratic Committee employee who died in an apparent robbery in Washington, D.C. I would add the birther lie to the list. There's a whole cottage industry of right-wing media in the business of propounding rumors, conspiracies, perverse theories without evidence. If this new case against InfoWars succeeds, does that put this category of right-wing media as an industry at risk?
It's a warning shot that you don't get to invent lies. You don't get to invent your own reality. One of the functions of defamation law is to protect individual reputation, but a broader function is to make sure that our public discourse has a necessary anchor in truth, or at least an attempt to find that truth.
I mentioned the proto-conspiracy of this age of defamation, Trump's birther lie about Barack Obama supposedly having been born in Kenya, which he repeated and repeated and repeated without any repercussions, certainly not political ones. I know there is a high threshold for libel or defamation against political figures because it can intrude on protected political speech. But are politicians absolutely invulnerable to the consequences of bald-faced lies about other politicians or anyone else?
So in 1964, in a case called New York Times versus Sullivan, which is probably the most famous First Amendment case of all time, the U.S. Supreme Court said that public officials suing for defamation would have to prove that the speaker intentionally lied or recklessly disregarded the truth of what they were saying about them, but they left open the possibility that the public official could, in fact, sue for defamation. As a practical matter, most politicians, particularly at the national level, don't sue for defamation. They will use the bully pulpit to get their message across. And that's why you see most presidents, even though they're routinely defamed, even with lies, they don't use a defamation suit to try to go after their critics.
Well, over the last year and a half, the president has repeatedly called Hillary Clinton a criminal. He has recently started calling James Comey a criminal. And there's some noises brewing about defamation suits in his claims about the fired Justice Department official, Andrew McCabe. These are not presidents. Is there a chance that they will take on the pastor of the bully pulpit?
Well, there very well may be, because it could be that we've crossed a threshold in our public discourse where people decide they are going to go to court, that it's not enough, given how polarized our debate is, to just reach out to the people that believe as they do, that they need an objective source to pronounce what the truth is. Although I would point out that Comey was certainly able to get his message out both in a book and in a well-publicized television interview.
I'm going to ask this question carefully because I don't want to be accused of inciting people to litigation. But is it possible that those who feel defamed by accusations made on Hannity's show, on Breitbart, or for that matter, Salon and The Nation, to go to court to seek remedy there and again to have some sort of salutary effect on the swamp that political discourse has become?
Well, potentially, that is one function of defamation law. However, there's a heavy dose of realism that needs to come with that. Most of us just don't have the resources to engage in that, either the financial resources to pay the lawyer or the emotional resources to see it through to the end.
Larissa, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Larissa Litsky is the dean of the University of Missouri School of Law.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. A warning here, this next segment includes graphic and difficult conversations about suicide. Just before dawn this past Saturday, early morning joggers and cyclists in Brooklyn's Prospect Park were met with a gruesome sight, the charred remains of a body. David Buckle, a high-profile LGBT rights lawyer, had set himself on fire as a protest against climate change.
And a handwritten suicide note found next to his body, he explained he doused himself in fossil fuels before lighting himself ablaze as a metaphor for the destruction of the planet.
He wrote that pollution was ravaging the planet. He was the lead attorney in a famous case involving transgender murder victim Brandon Tina. It was the subject of the 1999 Hilary Swank movie, Boys Don't Cry.
In a letter to the New York Times this week, two suicide prevention leaders wrote that it's a mistake to describe suicide as an understandable response to struggle and, quote, bad events. Decades of research, they wrote, suggests that mental health factors like depression and anxiety lead to suicide, not concerns over policy issues. Therein lies the dilemma for journalists covering suicides that are so horrifying precisely to get the public's attention. Andrew Poe is a professor of political science at Amherst College and is working on two books about politics and extreme protest. Self-immolation, he says, is defined as any suicidal sacrifice, but has been increasingly associated with death by fire since the 1963 suicide in Saigon of the Buddhist monk Thich Quang Duc. Duc acted in protest to South Vietnam's repressive Diem regime, and the Associated Press photo of him, his face half engulfed in flames, is among the most famous images of the 20th century. And the media reports were instantaneous.
And he assumed the lotus posture, and another priest stepped forward and poured gasoline over him, and then suddenly a towering flame. And what was in the priests and the nuns in the audience moaned and prostrated themselves toward this burning figure, and he sat there, unflinching, and the smell of gasoline and of burning flesh in the air for 10 minutes.
It required several monks and nuns coordinating, some lying in front of fire stations and police stations that might have been alerted to an emergency taking place, others preventing anyone from the crowd from attempting to douse the flames or extinguish the immolation from happening. It required much more than an individual engaged in a spontaneous action.
And it had the other, publicity advantage of not happening from a single gunshot, but from a, relatively prolonged event that is easily photographed, as this was, and found its way around the world very quickly. It was commented on by no one less than President John F. Kennedy.
That's right. And Kennedy's comment that, in a way, the images and Duke's act were provocative of so much emotion, that phrase, so much emotion, became a crystallization of what self-immolation could provoke. What is left out of Kennedy's reflection, and maybe is important to our thinking about self-immolation as an act of protest, is to consider what sort of emotion is actually generated by these types of events. I'm not persuaded, as others might be, that self-immolation is meant to provoke sympathy. I tend to think of it as specifically being intended to provoke horror.
Look, I know it's gruesome to even talk about these events in terms of efficacy, but if the suicide's motives are to raise awareness or indignation, there are more and less successful ways to go about that. I want to ask you about Emily Davidson, who died in a suicidal act, although maybe not intentionally suicidal, certainly reckless. She was a suffragette who went to a major horse race and did something very dangerous for the cause.
Emily Davidson had prepared to hang a sash that announced the suffragette cause, calling out to the world at perhaps the largest sporting event in Western history at that time, June 8th, 1913, that this right to vote was an issue that everyone needed to pay attention to. She entered the track where the horses were running and attempted to hang this sash upon the horse's neck. But
the king's horse in this unhappy incident is running third from last.
But she was struck by the horse and she was trampled.
It became a point of political reflection. So adherents to the suffragette movement pointed out that this was an act of heroism and she took a risk, but those are the risks that one has to take for a significant political cause. But her detractors said, no, in fact, this is actually a moment that reveals the zealotry and fanaticism of the suffragette movement, and we need to find political collaborators that we can work with, not fanatics who would go to such great lengths to enact their cause.
And then, on the other hand, there are times when, how can I put this, everything goes as planned. 98 years after Emily Davidson lost her life, in Tunisia, Mohamed Bouazizi set himself on fire in protest of the authoritarian regime there, and in so doing sparked the Arab Spring.
His closest friends, anguished by Mohammed's actions, took to the streets and began a popular uprising that lasted for weeks before it toppled the 23-year-old rule of President Zain Abidine Ben Ali.
Mohamed Bouazizi's case seems different to me. This was not an event that was planned, as was the case for Davidson's act or Duke's act. This, in fact, seems to have been a moment of exhaustion in response to systematic and repeated oppression by police forces. Bouazizi's self-immolation certainly became emblematic of the oppressions of Ben Ali's regime, but it's hard to say that Bouazizi himself had been working to accomplish the transformation of that regime or was concerned with vast political upheavals as a result of his actions.
I perceive self-immolation as a kind of Eastern export. Is there something different about Eastern religion and thought that's more welcoming to the concept?
It's my sense that, at least in the West, there is an anxiety about the morality of giving up of one's life, that Judeo-Christian ethical structures present a framework by which one's life is given, and so the sacrifice of it in suicide is bound up in a notion of waste. That isn't to say that suicide is a normal or justified activity in either discourse, but it is to say that, at least in the West, it has become specifically eschewed by religions.
So when it does happen here, as with David Buckle in Prospect Park, do the dynamics change, the public reaction, the assumptions? Does the revulsion and the sense of taboo trump the awareness raising in Brooklyn more than in Saigon?
It's my sense that more and more Americans are unfortunately facing the reality of suicide, both for political causes in the form of suicide terror, but also in rising rates of suicide in less political contexts. That rising awareness of suicide may be changing how Americans conceive of and act like David Buckle's.
The World Health Organization is not happy when the media lavish too much attention on these acts because they believe that it creates copycats, even epidemics. Does that concern you?
The media faces a danger in how it frames suicide protest. The personalization and psychologicalization of these acts has a tendency to refocus our attention to the personal and the private, as opposed to the cause that these persons might be giving their lives for. Not all self-immolations rise to the level of the public imagination. The media isn't always reporting on every suicide that takes place. It's certainly the case with Mohamed Bouazizi. There were dozens of self-immolations that took place in Tunisia that did not get reported on. And we know it's the case, however rare, that self-immolations have occurred in the United States before David Buckle. But I think it is a danger that the media faces, on the one hand, reporting these acts, but not reporting all of them. And which ones we choose to report and why, I think, is a serious question.
Let me ask you one final cynical question. As someone who has surveyed the history of self-immolations, do you think that as a category of political activity, it is, on balance, a particularly successful one?
I don't think it is an effective mode of protest in itself. I think, in the end, self-immolation becomes effective in how it is received and the context it appears in and how it's reported on. It really is rare that such an act would provoke political transformation. And so much attention to it as a possibility in comparison to other modes of protest, I think, is worrisome.
Andrew, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob.
Andrew Poe is a professor of political science at Amherst College. Self-immolation may indeed be concentrated in the East, but David Buckle's fiery death this week in Brooklyn was by no means unprecedented here. Just a few years ago, a man who had similarly devoted himself to social justice also took his life. He barely made the news. In 2014, in the small East Texas town of Grand Saline, population 3,100, a retired pastor named Charles Moore doused himself in gasoline in the parking lot of a Dollar General store and flicked a lighter. He left behind a note saying that his death was a protest of Grand Saline's racist history and present. He wrote, quote, "I've come to believe that only my self-immolation will get the attention of anybody and perhaps inspire some to higher service." Michael Hall wrote about Charles Moore for Texas Monthly Magazine. Mike, welcome to OTM.
Thanks, Bob.
Who was Charles Moore?
Charles was an enlightened progressive minister long before that was a hip thing to be. In super conservative East Texas, even back in 1954, he was preaching, for example, that Brown v. Board of Education was a good thing, which is just nuts in East Texas in 1954, and he caught a lot of flack for it. And he spent a lot of time fighting for people who were disenfranchised, fighting for poor people. He was personally welcoming gays to his church here in South Austin. He went on a hunger strike to try to make this a real issue for the Methodist Church. And ultimately, the Methodist Church made a few begrudging changes, but nothing really big. Although eventually, I mean, the Methodist Church, like all churches, has slowly been breaking down some of these walls. And Charles's peers believe that he had a lot to do with that.
In any event, by the time he poured gasoline on himself and set himself aflame in that empty parking lot, he was a deeply disappointed man. And his suicide note specified why he was making the ultimate sacrifice.
He actually titled it, "Gasoline, Repent of Your Racism." He spoke of all the people who had been lynched there and set on fire, and he said that his sacrifice, he was going to join them in their martyrdom and to give his body to be burned.
Here is some tape from a documentary called Man on Fire, a film that sprang from your Texas Monthly piece.
For a majority of like the black people in this town, they are not going to go to Grand Saline. They're not going to go to Grand Saline. They're not going to hang out in Grand Saline. They don't have any friends from Grand Saline. And they're just like, they're still raceless. The Klan's there, you know. They lynch people there. They don't like you. They're going to chase you out of town. They're going to try to fight you. I mean, like literally, like it's like taboo.
I remember one time we had a track meet, and the next day, a guy says, "Did y'all see all those monkeys walking around on their hind legs last night?" And it was things like that. You'd hear it every day. I probably heard the N-word every day at school.
However, Moore's accusations that Grand Saline had a history of lynchings and burnings doesn't comport with actual history, does it?
Right. I mean, you will see no black people in Grand Saline in 2018. It has this reputation as being this terrible, terrible place for black folks. And Charles grew up there. And so he heard these stories, and there were stories about there's a part of town called Pole Town. And it was said to be a place where African Americans were decapitated and their heads were put on poles. There's a bridge there where the legend had it that many African Americans were lynched from. And so, I mean, he grew up in this cauldron of stories. But on reflection, and I went and talked to a bunch of people who would know African Americans as well as some of the local historians in Grand Saline, and there is no record of any lynchings of blacks there. That idea that Grand Saline was this, you know, terrible lynching ground is just not true.
All right. Well, let's just say that the historical facts obscure the larger truth of institutional racism in this little town. But in any event, Moore's self-immolation, if it was meant to make a big statement, it didn't seem to do that. It didn't get mentioned in the national news when it happened. And it wasn't even a big story in East Texas.
Right. The Grand Saline paper did a story on it a couple days later, didn't even mention him. When the Tyler paper did it a few days after that, they mentioned him, and I think the headline was Martyr or Madman. It took a while for people to actually really look into why he might have done it. And one of Charles's role models was Quang Duc, the South Vietnamese monk who had self-immolated back in 1963. Charles had his picture, the famous photograph. Charles had that picture on his desk. He had left it there to be seen. So Quang Duc was his hero. Quang Duc, though, had gone out of his way to publicize what he did. They had notified a bunch of the media. Charles didn't. Instead, Charles chose this virtually empty parking lot of a Dollar General store in Grand Saline, where there were four young people taking a cigarette break from working at the spa there, as his only witnesses.
911.
This is Angie at the Dollar General.
In what city?
At Grand Saline, and a man's on fire out in the parking lot.
The man is on fire?
Yes, a man just set himself on fire.
He had previously planned to kill himself for somewhat different reasons. Just on the question of messaging, it's hard to know what really he was trying to say.
Yeah, it really is. In his initial letters, he was protesting the death penalty. He was protesting the denial of rights to homosexuals. And ultimately, he settled on the racism, American racism, which is something that he had seen his whole life. I mean, one of his friends said at the end, his action was a symbol of solidarity with people on the margins. It was meant to call us to respond, basically for all injustice. I mean, yeah, Charles couldn't pick a single one, but he was always out there for all kinds of injustices.
Long before his suicide, the guy made other great sacrifices, including his own closest relationships, his family. He put his pastoral work and his humanitarianism ahead of his family and ended up twice divorced, became estranged from his children. In your piece, I see a man swinging between long bouts of depression and a sort of messianic mania. I mean, if you wish to make the ultimate protest, how is the outside world to know where your protest begins and mere personal misery or mental struggle ends?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good question. I mean, how can we possibly know? He left his two sons behind, and he took his wife to India, and his sons were basically raised in foster homes, helping poor people. It was so important that he would leave his children behind. You know, I think that there is a certain amount of craziness that comes with the territory of being somebody who feels and thinks so much that he loses himself in his work. He was so desperately searching for some kind of meaning. But when I went back and looked through his life, I found this unbelievable life's work. You know, he probably forgot all the individual people along the way who he helped or who he preached to or he ministered to. I talked to those people. I read the sermons he gave, which were fantastic. He was a great preacher. You could say that he lost his way. He stopped ministering and he stopped reaching out and just basically started reaching in.
Did he in any way get Grand Saline to repent or at least give some thought as to the values and history of the community? Is anyone more enlightened as a consequence of his self-immolation?
Whether Charles advanced the ball in Grand Saline, I don't know. I mean, we're talking about it now. Granted, we're only talking about it because another man did the same thing this past week. I do know that people read magazine stories and people watch documentary films and people listen to radio shows. So maybe his message is getting spread out into the world. Maybe not in the way Quang Duc did, but you know, people are talking about his ultimate sacrifice.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thank you, Bob. I really appreciate it.
Michael Hall wrote about Charles Moore for Texas Monthly Magazine. The piece called Man on Fire is also the title of a new documentary about Grand Saline after Charles Moore's death.
This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. April 19th, which was this past Thursday, marks an odd holiday known as Bicycle Day. The day, now 75 years ago, when Swiss scientist Albert Hofmann rode his bike home from work after dosing himself with his lab concoction, lysergic acid diethylamide, or LSD. Hofmann is what launches us today into an exploration of a moment when an evangelist of acid would emerge from a Menlo Park hospital lab and plow through the nation's gray flannel culture in a candy-colored bus. I speak, of course, of Ken Kesey, the enigmatic author behind One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and the driving force in the electric Kool-Aid acid test, Tom Wolfe's seminal work in new journalism, which turns 50 this year. We ponder how acid shaped Kesey and denormalized American conformity with River Donahue, a filmmaker and writer based in Brooklyn.
Kesey's story really starts in the late 50s when he was a graduate student at Stanford's creative writing program. Up until that point, Kesey was sort of this all-American farm boy. He was a college jock, married his high school sweetheart. He had a very wholesome childhood. But when he got to Stanford, he needed money to support his new family, so he got this job basically being a guinea pig for clinical drug trials in a nearby hospital.
The drug trials at Menlo Park Veterans Hospital were marketed as research for treating mental illness, but we know today that they were part of Project MKUltra, the CIA's mind control study. Kesey was given a few different drugs, an early antidepressant called IT-290, a vomit-inducing antibiotic called Ditrim.
And one of the pills was LSD.
And so how did he feel on LSD?
Well, I mean, you got to put yourself in Kesey's shoes at that point, right? It's the end of the 50s. It's like Mad Men era. It's this like suburbs and housewives and like dad with the briefcase and the suit going off to work. It was a very like repressed time. There's a very narrow window of what was socially appropriate. And LSD cracked Kesey's brain open to all these new possibilities and new perspectives and new ways of viewing the world.
We actually have some audio from one of Kesey's first experiences with LSD in the Menlo Park Hospital. This was in 1959 or 60.
Yeah.
How are you feeling right now? You seem to feel there's still some effect of the drug?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he's in this little white box, this tiny little room in the hospital's mental ward. And he's sitting there taking this LSD, and periodically orderlies and nurses are coming in and out, taking blood samples and urine samples. It was not really the ideal place to have an acid trip.
It's 12:45, and I'm high out of my mind. Such a good drug. In that I suddenly am filled with this great loving and understanding of people. Nobody's going to get high on this and go out and rape somebody. They might go out and take a little girl by the hand and give her a bottle of flowers, but that would be all. So I say, public support has to get behind it. We need a huge missionary. We need a messiah.
We need a huge missionary. We need a messiah.
Yeah. I think Kesey really had the spiritual awakening. I think he saw that there was a path to go down, that all these, you know, structures that he had sort of accepted as reality weren't really reality. And there were all these different options out there that he had the ability to go explore and sort of figure out where he fit within those.
He found himself catalyzed creatively by those sessions in Menlo Park.
In doing these drug tests and in experiencing LSD, Kesey had an idea. Oh, naturally, I'll go get a job at the mental hospital as a night watchman and, you know, sneak some of that acid out for my friends back at home. And also, as a night watchman, have a lot of time to sit and write. And that's where, late one night high on psychedelics, he has this vision of one institution patient called Chief Broom, this like hulking Native American man. And he just starts writing, and he writes 5 pages, 6 pages of this book that ends up becoming One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
A humanizing portrait of mental illness and civil disobedience. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, released in 1962, made Kesey a literary sensation at the age of 27. It also boosted his profile as a burgeoning acid messiah. A devoted entourage that he would later dub the Merry Pranksters began to coalesce around him.
Kesey took some of the money from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest and bought this house in La Honda, California, out in the woods. And that house in La Honda became sort of this proto-commune with people flowing in and out. And he also had the LSD, and he was throwing really good parties out there in the woods. So people naturally gravitated towards him.
Among the merry pranksters, Neil Cassady, a speed freak and the muse of the beat generation, inspiring the main character in On the Road by Jack Kerouac, and the heartthrob vagabond in Allen Ginsberg's poem Howl.
Neil Cassady, secret hero of these poems, joy to the memory of his innumerable lays of girls in empty lots and diner backyards.
It was Cassady who would ultimately drive that legendary bus.
To get into the bus trip, we have to start in 1963. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest became a Broadway play starring Kirk Douglas. And so Kesey and a couple of his friends drove out to New York to go check the play out, and on their way back,
President Kennedy and Texas Governor John Connally were shot from ambush today in a motorcade. Both are still alive, but in very serious condition in the emergency room at the Parkland Memorial Hospital in Dallas, Texas.
They're sharing this very intimate moment in this collective space in the car, passing through America and the small towns. It gave Kesey this understanding of the road trip as a quintessentially American experience. And so once they got back to La Honda, he said, let's go back next year. 1964 World's Fair is going to be happening in New York about the same time as the publication of his follow-up to One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, this book, Sometimes a Great Notion. Unfortunately, there's so many people hanging out around Kesey's house, you know, they can't all fit in the station wagon, so they need something a little bigger. And that's where the bus comes in. It's this 1938 International Harvester school bus. They bought it for like $1,500 from a guy who had 11 kids, and he had sort of outfitted it so his kids could sleep in it. Kesey and his friends cut a turret in the ceiling and put this big deck on the roof and wired it for sound.
There's the famous paint job.
They had a bunch of Day-Glow paint floating around, and somebody decided to throw a big smear of orange on there, and somebody else decided, well, we'll add a little red and add a little blue and a little green. You know, the thing with LSD is that it doesn't really inspire great fine motor skills. So by the time they were done, it was like somebody ate a bunch of markers and threw them up or something.
You have two documents that depict this trip. One is the electric Kool-Aid acid test, Tom Wolfe's.
Mm-hmm. At the time that electric Kool-Aid acid test finally came out, the hippie movement was in full swing. I guess the book functioned as this behind-the-scenes look at how everything started, how the hippie movement became what it was. Kesey taught the hippies how to be hippies. Before the phrase hippie existed, before anyone knew what LSD was, I mean, they were in the bus and people didn't even know what to make of them. People thought maybe they were in the circus or like Escape from the Loony Bin or something.
What did Tom Wolfe make of them?
Tom Wolfe saw that Kesey was this quintessential American figure. A little P.T. Barnum, a little spiritual guru.
We actually spoke to Tom Wolfe.
His favorite saying was, you're either on the bus or off the bus. And if you were off the bus, it meant you were out of the greatest experience human beings could have. Kesey was striving to become the leader of the entire psychedelic movement. What appealed to me the most was just, this was newsworthy. It was gold for me.
I mentioned that there were two documents. The other one, Kesey and the Merry Pranksters documented their travels for a movie that they never released.
He had this concept of everybody's movies, that everybody is living out a script.
Kesey believed that acid could serve as a way of recognizing your script and a way to break character, to live freely in the moment.
I feel like you only come to this movie once, and if you don't get something rewarding out of every minute you're sitting there, then you're blowing your ticket.
We got hold of the Kesey tapes, most of which have never been heard by the public. And let me tell you, a band of proto-hippies cruising through the South, drinking acid-laced Kool-Aid in a psychedelic school bus with a manic Neil Cassady at the wheel, it all sounds just about as you'd imagine.
And we're just barrel-assing across the desert, and Cassidy's got his shirt off, and he's just sweating and sweating and sweating, and he's just talking.
My merry band of pranksters won't be lugging around in the dirt. Come on, come on. No, no, none of this misery stuff. Come on, this is the merry gang.
God, look at it. Look at that. Get that.
Hey, yeah, take a picture of that.
out of the bus. Out of the bus.
Yes, my chillin'. Yes, my pranksters.
Reaching New York was their final destination. They were really expecting this hero's welcome. And first, Cassidy sets up this party with Kerouac. And Kesey, of course, idolizes Kerouac. But once they got to this party, it just didn't work. Kerouac was, you know, pretty late in his life and an alcoholic.
I've seen film of that. Yeah. He looks very glum, almost sour.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, they drive up to visit Timothy Leary, a former Harvard academic. He's kind of an acid philosopher.
Turn off your mind. Relax. Float downstream.
It was supposed to be, at least in Kesey's mind, a meeting of the foremost psychedelic experimenter of the East and the West.
But it didn't work out like that.
No.
Timothy Leary was in this big mansion in Millbrook with rolling hills and stone bridges.
Sounds perfect.
It was lovely. But Kesey and his friends roll up throwing smoke bombs off the top of the roof, and all the members of Leary's group just sort of ran inside scared. Leary himself was just coming down off of a psychedelic trip and was in a very peaceful place and didn't really want to be involved with all that raucous energy that Kesey and his friends brought along. And they go back to La Honda and start trying to cut together the movie that they shot. What they would do is every week they would cut the footage together, and then on Saturday they would have a screening of the week's cut. These big parties became very unwieldy until finally Kesey decided, okay, you know, my family's living here. I have a couple of young kids. Maybe we should find another place to screen the movie. And out of that came these things called the acid tests.
What was an acid test? I've never been clear on that.
Well, again, the pranksters defy definition a little bit. Everything that Kesey was prototyping at La Honda, this sort of communal experience and this proto-hippie lifestyle, like the acid tests were the opportunity for him to bring that into public.
It was like a church group, like the early Christians, who were trying to spread their message. Kesey felt the way you spread them, you had a gigantic party.
Wild multimedia experiences around the San Francisco Bay Area. This band, The Warlocks, would play before they changed their name to The Grateful Dead.
Mm-hmm.
And like early psychedelic visuals, like that oil and water projections and strobe lights.
Of course, Kesey was attracting the attention of the police. Mm-hmm. LSD was still legal in the mid-60s, so the cops eventually pinned him with a marijuana charge.
And since that was his second marijuana charge, he was facing, you know, 5 years in prison with no chance of parole. And in typical prankster fashion, Kesey hatched a plan to fake his own death and go on the run to Mexico.
And did it work?
Well, the run to Mexico was successful. Even in the suicide note that Kesey wrote, he said in parentheses, like, I don't think anyone's actually going to believe this, but I'm going to give it a try. He had one of his family members that looked like him drive around the Bay Area and then go up to a cliff and, you know, throw his Kesey's signature boots in the water and leave the suicide note. I don't know if it really threw the cops off the scent very long, but it gave Kesey enough time to make it across the Mexico border.
Kesey fled to Mexico in January 1966 and spent the next 8 months as a fugitive, well aware that he was being tracked by the FBI. Meanwhile, word had spread about the movement he had helped start as kids from all across the country flocked to Haight-Ashbury, where he'd staged many acid-laced happenings. They were in search of what he created, whether they knew it or not.
While he was gone, it took shape without him. And while he was in Mexico, Kesey sort of came to this realization that he had gotten everything that he could from LSD. That awakening consciousness that he got, like, it was awake. And to have it be sustainable, he had to find sort of a chemical-free psychedelic experience.
In October 1966, Kesey was picked up by the FBI outside of San Francisco. He struck a deal with local law enforcement, promising to hold an acid graduation, a public renunciation of LSD. Almost a year before the Summer of Love, this graduation was a radical notion. Perhaps too radical.
He may have gotten out of jail, but the followers that he had inspired had sort of grown up without him and weren't really keen on the idea of stopping taking drugs because they liked the drugs. I think that the moment that the hippie movement refused to give up acid and follow Kesey further, it's the moment that the movement stalled. And I think whatever last vestiges of the hippie movement still exist today are still stuck there in that same place, you know, sort of leaning on the crutch of drugs.
Why do you care so much about Ken Kesey?
So I grew up in Eugene, Oregon, which is where Kesey sort of retired to with the Pranksters in the 70s. And Eugene is a place fundamentally changed by Kesey. It's sort of the last enclave of the hippie ideals. I mean, my name is River. I sort of come from it. And I come from a different piece of it. My parents were more this like new age personal growth movement in the 80s.
They're a full generation after Kesey.
That's right. But some of that comes from Kesey. I think that creating this heavy, deep, and real emotional group work without drugs is sort of what this personal growth movement in the 80s was also attempting to do. My father gave me a copy of Electric Kool-Aid Acid Test when I was in sixth grade, and he said, "Here's the history of your home." My mother wasn't so happy with that.
Kesey said the acid tests, the noisy parties fueled by LSD, were a way to measure a person's willingness to discover what was out there if you moved beyond the norm.
It was a test, and there were people that passed and there were people that didn't pass. To give you an example of somebody who passed, some businessman just walking around the street came in. For a buck, you got to see us make all our noise and the dead make all their noise and anything else that happened. This guy was in a suit, had an umbrella, and he got the customary cup of stuff. About midnight, you could see him really get ripped. Probably never been anything but drunk on beer. But he looked around, saw all these strange people, and he looked down. The spotlight was showing down on him. He saw a shadow. He would stand up straight, put that umbrella over his shoulder, and he says, "The king walks." So the king turns around. Now the king will dance.
Fifty years after the electric Kool-Aid acid test, we're still being tested. Connecting to something bigger, something beyond what seems to be a profoundly abnormal kind of norm, is back. Or maybe it's being fueled by the realization that the norm was never normal, or shouldn't have been. Anyway, it's creeping back. And so is LSD, if only to make moving beyond the norm a little easier. Much thanks to filmmaker and writer River Donahue, who brought us the story and then talked to us about it.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, Michael Loewinger, and Leah Fetter. We had more help from John Hanrahan, Isaac Napel, and Philip Yiannopoulos.
On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
On the Media is supported by the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.